This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Kabashi acknowledged that the dispersal operation got out of hand.
That's Mohamed Alamin reporting on statements regarding the deadly crackdown on protesters in Sudan. Details coming up. Also, the World Health Organization is meeting now in Geneva to decide whether to declare the DRC outbreak an international emergency. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the confirmation of Ebola cases in Uganda this week has panicked residents living near the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo. They fear screening points are insufficient and that the disease could hit their districts. However, Ugandan government says it has stepped up Ebola screening at all entry points into the country. Meanwhile, the World Health Organization is meeting now in Geneva to decide whether to declare the DRC outbreak an international emergency. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Residents on the shores of the Ugandan side of Lake Albert say boats carrying Congolese refugees dock on a daily basis. They are worried that in the wake of two Ebola deaths in Kasese border district, the deadly hemorrhagic fever could easily spill to other districts as many of the Congolese enter Uganda unscreened. Stephen Mande is a resident of Hoima district on the shores of Lake Albert.
There is an Ebola case in Kasese, and there is no proper measures from the government that is put in places around the landing sites to screen foreigners, so our lives are at stake.
Since last December, Uganda has had an influx of Congolese refugees fleeing tribal clashes in Lendu. An estimated 25,000 people also cross from Congo daily, mostly to trade and seek health care in Uganda. However, health officials say surveillance has been heightened to ensure all DRC residents who enter Uganda are thoroughly screened for Ebola. Dr. Frederick Bianume is the Hoima District Health Officer.
We are training health workers around that point, and we are training also community-based health providers for surveillance, including the beach management units. We are putting them on board, or any manager in the fishing and the community leaders, so that they do an assessment, because we are aware people can come in and enter the community without our notes, but they will be directing them to our screening points.
Dr. Jane Ruth Acheng, Uganda's health minister, says no border crossings are planned due to the Ebola outbreak. Instead, screening points will be instituted at all entry points, including ports, landing sites, and airports.
And we have agreed that from today onwards, they will have people to man the porous borders on both sides. Uganda doesn't have security challenges, and our response teams are moving to all parts of the country, but specifically concentrating efforts in Kasese.
In Kasese district, 6 Ebola checkpoints have been erected. The isolation center at Entebbe International Airport, which has been idle for months, has been reinstituted. Uganda President Yoweri Museveni has urged the public to avoid handshakes, hugs, public gatherings and burials to help prevent the spread of Ebola. Early this week, Uganda confirmed 3 cases of Ebola, 2 of whom have died. They were part of a family that crossed from DRC after nursing and burying a sick relative. 1 Ebola patient and 4 suspected cases, all members of the same family, have been repatriated to DRC for further treatment. Uganda's health ministry says that leaves no confirmed case of Ebola in the country at the moment. Uganda has had 5 Ebola outbreaks since 2000. These are the first confirmed cases outside the DRC since current outbreak was reported in August. As of June 4th, 2025 confirmed and probable cases have been recorded in the DRC, with 2/3 dying. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
Sudan's ruling military council has acknowledged it ordered the June 3rd attack on protesters in Khartoum that left dozens of people dead. Meanwhile, talks between the council and opposition parties on forming an interim government appears to be stalled again. Mohamed Alamin has more from Khartoum.
Shamsaldeen Al-Kabashi, spokesman for the Transitional Military Council, the TMC, said the council ordered security forces to break up the sit-in protest outside the defense ministry. Speaking at a press conference on Thursday, Al-Kabashi said all parts of the government signed off on the order.
في الليلة السابقة للتنفيذ دعونا لاجتماع موسع.
He said the entire leaderships of the army, rapid support forces, RSF, security organs, and the police, as well as the judiciary and the general prosecutor, participated in the order and the plans of the sit-in dispersal. Protesters had camped outside the defense ministry for 8 weeks, demanding Sudan be returned to civilian rule after the military's overthrow of longtime President Omar al-Bashir on April 11. Al-Kabashi acknowledged that the dispersal operation got out of hand.
وجهنا القيادات العسكرية بالتخطيط لفض هذا الاعتصام.
The TMC ordered the leaders of our forces on the ground to plan and implement for the dispersal of the sit-in, but violations were committed during the operation, he said. The health ministry said at least 61 people were killed during the raid. Doctors aligned with the opposition boosted the death toll at more than 100. Meanwhile, it appears the Transitional Military Council, TMC, and Opposition Alliance of the Forces of Freedom and Change, FFC, have reached a new standoff in their talks on an interim government. A leading member of the FFC, Medani Abbas, emphasized the opposition wants an independent investigation of the June 3rd raid, redeployment of military forces outside Khartoum, and a transfer of power to civilians. We told the Ethiopian Prime Minister during our meeting last Friday that we totally rejected any kind of direct talks with the TMC unless it's on the procedural ways of handing the power to the civilian authority. The U.S. also wants to see transfer of power to civilians, as a top U.S. diplomat to Africa, Tibor Nagy, told reporters during a visit Thursday to Khartoum.
I also wanted to assure the chairman of the United States full faith and confidence in the African Union and also IGAD, Prime Minister Abiy's mediation role and support in helping Sudan through this very, very sensitive period. Because the entire international community, and I know I speak for the entire international community, wants exactly what the Sudanese people want. We all want a civilian-led government that is acceptable to the Sudanese people.
The TMC and FFC agreed last week to resume negotiation after meeting with the Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. The two sides agreed in principle last month to form an interim government made up of both civilians and military, but they failed to agree about which side would have a majority of seats in the proposed council. On Thursday, the TMC spokesman rejected the FFC's latest demand, indicating the talks are at an impasse again. Mohamed Elamin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Hundreds of health experts and leaders have gathered in Kigali for an international conference ahead of World Blood Donors Day today. They are discussing challenges that hinder the donation of safe blood in Africa, where 800,000 women die of lack of blood during pregnancy. Eugene Wimana has more details from Kigali.
This is why the government of Rwanda put in place...
They are discussing how to save lives globally with a focus on Africa. The World Health Organization says one pint of blood can help save as many as three people. The problem is how to foster the blood donation spirit on the continent. Dr. Ndimbabazi Patrick is the state minister in the Rwanda's Ministry of Health.
And we know that the voluntary non-remunerated blood donation is indeed a pillar of a safe and adequate national blood supply that meets the transfusion requirements to all patients.
Rwanda National Blood Service, NBS, says health workers in Africa need to change some bad perceptions based on myths. Some say donating blood makes people unhealthy, or receiving blood means absorbing the donor's traits. Dr. Katare Swaibu is the director of NBS.
It has nothing to do with the character of someone. It has nothing to do with the genetic makeup of a certain individual. So these are myths that are outside here, and what we are doing is to conduct a campaign to tell the people that, please, this what you're believing is not true. This is the correct thing that you should believe.
Among other blood donation challenges in Africa is to get in touch with donors who have rare blood types in the negative rhesus group. But basing on Rwanda's experience, Dr. Katale gives examples of how this problem can be fixed.
So what we have done as the Rwanda National Blood Service is to have a special donor base of those donors with the rare blood types, and we have their contacts. And whenever there is a need, whenever our stock is going low, is running low, we call upon them to come and donate the blood to save lives of the patients in the hospitals.
Among the attendees of this conference is Arjun Prasad Mainal, an American who has donated the blood 171 times in 32 years. So far, he has donated 85 liters. He urges African youth to follow his lead and save their relatives' lives.
And I like to encourage the African youth to donate blood at least once a year. So I want to give this message for them.
All of these insights aim at saving lives, including 800,000 African women who die due to a lack of safe blood. WHO says more efforts in sensitization are needed because 38 countries in the African region report collecting fewer than 10 donations per 1,000 population. And more than 50% of the blood supply is still dependent on family members and paid blood donors. More voluntary donors are highly needed to save thousands of lives in Africa. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
A top UN AIDS official is in Zimbabwe as the country faces a moderate shortage of the antiretroviral drugs that stop the progress of the disease. The situation is bad for HIV-positive Zimbabweans, but worse for prisoners living with the virus who say they are struggling to get treatment for opportunistic infections. Columbus Mavunga has the story from Harare.
Officials say Zimbabwe's maximum security prison is overcrowded, and that is putting a strain on resources, including medicines for inmates who have HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Chiedza Shuashira is one of the HIV-positive inmates. The 18-year-old says the shortage of ARVs is not a big problem, but the shortage of other drugs. Even painkillers we do not have. So if those kids, children of inmates, fall sick, there is nothing to give them, she says. Officials are saying things are tough out there, so there's nothing they can do. At least we have cotrimoxazole and other ARVs. But if we fall sick, it will be a problem. We appeal to those at home or those who can help us with medical drugs and antibiotics, as the prison hospital just has ARVs, said Chiwashira. Dr. Blessing Doroba, the head of the Chukurubi Maximum Prison Hospital, says the national pharmaceutical company is keeping the facility supplied with ARV drugs for now, but acknowledges other drugs are a problem.
In terms of supply of ARV drugs and TB drugs, we are well covered. Natfarm supplies us. We've not yet problems with in that respect. But however, in terms of other opportunistic infections, your pneumonias, your meningitis, and even analgesia, we are in short supply of those drugs, such as antihypertensives, anti-diabetics.
What would be the cause of the shortages?
We are normally supplied by Natfarm, so we depend on them. If they have no stocks, then they don't deliver.
Shannon Heder, the deputy executive director of UNAIDS, said she came to Zimbabwe to see how the country is helping vulnerable groups such as prison inmates and sex workers. Heder says Zimbabwe has a good track record on AIDS, noting that the country introduced a tax to help patients known as the AIDS levy back in the 1990s.
But
what got us to this point in the response won't necessarily get us to the next level, because what's left to do might be a little bit more complicated than what we did first. And so I think Zimbabwe has the capacity to really accelerate, to meet the 2020 goals, to be a model of the response. But that will take doubling down in this next 18 months and filling some of these gaps, and particularly filling the gaps with people that are often left behind.
Raymond Yekeye, the head of the Zimbabwe's National AIDS Council, blames the shortage of medications on Zimbabwe's chronic shortage of foreign currency.
I think we do have the AIDS levy, and it is sufficient to cover the gap that we require. But we obviously have not accessed the foreign currency that we require to import the medicines.
The lack of foreign currency has also made the country unable to import basic needs like food and fuel. Earlier this week, the country's health minister, Obadiah Moyo, said Harare has begun receiving drugs from countries like India, which donated medical drugs worth $250,000. That might ease the problem of shortages for prisoners with HIV who can't work to buy medicine on their own. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
UN agencies warn millions of people in South Sudan will face acute shortages of food by the end of July, with tens of thousands experiencing famine-like conditions. A new report released Friday by the UN's World Food Programme, Food and Agriculture Organization, and UNICEF, along with the government of South Sudan, assesses the food situation in the world's youngest country. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Food is always in short supply during South Sudan's lean season. But this year, the situation is worse than usual because of a much-delayed rainfall on top of an economic crisis and population displacement due to conflict. The United Nations estimates nearly 7 million South Sudanese, or 61% of the population, will face acute levels of food insecurity in about 6 weeks' time. World Food Programme spokesman Hervé Verhoosel tells VOA the crisis will be especially dire for thousands of people living in inaccessible parts of former Jonglei, Lakes and Upper Nile states.
21,000 people in the country are very in a catastrophic situation. They need very urgently access to that food. But we know that urgent food assistance is needed in most of the country, especially because of the conflict and because of the season. And that's at the end of July that we will have a very difficult time, and most of the people will need that food assistance.
Verhoosel says people living in the worst affected areas are experiencing famine-like conditions with little or nothing to eat or to feed their families. The agency currently is providing food for 2.77 million people. Verhoosel says the WFP plans to scale up aid to reach more than 5 million by the end of the year. The UN Children's Fund and partners say they too will scale up services to reach more children affected by severe acute malnutrition with therapeutic feeding. The Food and Agriculture Organization reports it is providing new varieties of seed suited to local conditions. It says it also is training farmers in techniques that will reduce losses from drought and flooding. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Cameroon's military is taking 55 truckloads of humanitarian aid to its English-speaking regions amid heavy clashes with separatist forces that have killed at least 25 people in the past 2 weeks. Some question whether the troops are the right people to distribute the aid. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaounde.
A crowd of about 200 is gathered in central Yaoundé to witness 40 trucks, most of them belonging to the military, depart with humanitarian assistance to the troubled English-speaking northwest and southwest regions. Among them is 41-year-old teacher Peter Siwe, his wife and three children, who escaped fighting in the town of Kumbu and have been in Yaoundé for over a year. Siwe, who has been jobless, says he thought the food, medical supplies, and mattresses were to be distributed in Yaoundé. What Cameroon really needs, he says, is for the government to resolve the crisis so they can return and build their communities.
For how long will you keep feeding the people? What should be on the spotlight now should be resolving the crisis. So that people can go back home, they continue to work their farms, continue to go to the market. I see people who can barely feed now, people who were well to do, people who have been frustrated, but they are ready to go back home.
Forces wanting to separate the English-speaking regions from majority Francophone Cameroon have been fighting the government since 2017. This week, Cameroon's military reported that clashes had killed at least 11 separatists in the town of Jakiri, 6 in Woum, 4 in Kambé, and 3 in Mamfé. Residents said the casualties were higher than reported by the government, and that at least 5 troops were also killed. Peter Sadjo, traditional ruler of the northwestern village of Misong and spokesperson for people displaced from his village to Yaoundé, says he does not have confidence the military, who he accuses of excessive violence, can distribute aid effectively.
Inasmuch as the state wants to come in with soldiers, the lacking link is the presence of the chiefs. Chiefs have suffered. Some have been killed. Some palaces have been burnt. Some farms have been taken.
Paul Atanganji, Cameroon's Minister of Territorial Administration, insists the soldiers are best equipped to distribute the aid.
We have military trucks because not only they have to protect the convoys, but they are part of the distribution machine, because the military also do distribution in remote areas where we don't have access. This is a clear example that the government has always taken this problem seriously.
Cameroon has always accused international NGOs of exaggerating the crisis in the country's two English-speaking regions to give an impression it is not doing enough to solve the crisis. The United Nations estimates at least 1,800 people have been killed and more than 530,000 displaced since fighting broke out in the English-speaking northwest and southwest regions in 2017. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Thanks for choosing The Voice of America. I'm Yehis Wuhib in Washington.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
Stand up!